Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600, and thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks. Welcoming back to the show this morning is Diana Good, who's the executive director for the Connecticut Council on Problem Gambling. Good morning, Diana. Thank you so much for being here. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Good morning.
So, Diana, first of all, tell people about the Connecticut Council on Problem Gambling. I know you're not for or against, per se, publicly, the idea of online gambling when we pass that here in Connecticut, but it's really that you guys are a resource for people who struggle with gambling addiction, correct?
Absolutely. We're not for or against. We just want to make sure that there are safeguards in place for people who gamble and run into trouble. There are lots of people who gamble and it's fun and they don't spend more than they want to. And we're not worried about those people. We're worried about those people who gamble and it gets out of control.
So we had Governor Lamont on recently and he admitted on the air, he had said, unfortunately, I hate to report that we are getting, there's an increase of calls for gambling addiction and that the phone is just ringing off the hook, essentially, ever since we passed a law that allows for online gambling and sports betting to be as easy as accessing it right on your own phone at home. Can you comment on that, what you guys are experiencing?
Yeah, one of the things that we used to say before online gambling and sports betting became legal is if you lived within 40 miles of a casino, the odds doubled that you would become a problem gambler. Now, everyone has a casino in their house, and it's just so easy to log on, lose time, and lose a lot of money.
So are you guys getting a lot of phone calls?
A lot more calls. The calls to our hotline have increased about 200% since last October.
Wow. That's pretty significant. And who's calling? Like, if you were to look at a demographic, I mean, obviously, there's many people from different walks of life, but the majority of your calls, who's calling?
The real shift in demographic is that now we're seeing more males in their 20s who are calling the helpline. When you used to think about the problem gambler, you used to think about the little old lady at the slot machine. Now it's the 20-something male that's gambling on sports betting.
Now, are these are, I don't want to call them kids. They're not kids. They're adults. But are these people who are just getting out of college? Are these young professionals, like where they don't know how to manage money? Because I know one of the things Governor Lamont was proud of is the fact that with online gambling is that you have a limit, essentially. It'll cut you off when you get to that certain dollar limit. Are we looking at people who just don't know what their limit should be or don't really know how to manage finances, do you think?
There are lots of misconceptions about that cutoff limit. So that's one of the things that we're concerned about. It doesn't necessarily cut you off. It gives you a little notice that says, this is how much you've spent. This is how much time you've spent. It doesn't necessarily shut you out. So a lot of what we're concerned about are the misconceptions about what you think's going on that what really isn't going on. So a lot of the, again, I call them kids also, even though they're not really kids, who are betting in their 20s are college kids. They're kids who maybe have their first job and just don't understand exactly how the game works and exactly the concept of what's happening. They keep thinking that if they keep betting, eventually they're going to win, and that's not how it works. You may never win. You may continue to lose forever. A lot of them say, I didn't realize I was such a bad gambler. You're kind of the poster child for a good gambler. The odds are against you. The house always wins. That saying is there for a reason. Mm-hmm. You're not necessarily going to eventually win your money back, and that's where these kids really run into trouble. Also, a lot of them may be isolated and at home because of COVID. Sometimes a lot of problem gamblers are also introducing alcohol, and you're drinking and making irrational decisions because you're home and no one's really calling you out on it.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing about online gambling and sports betting on your phone is we used to say before when you were gambling, you had to get up and you had to go somewhere. You had to put on clothes. You had to go to a place to be able to gamble, whether it was a corner store for a lottery ticket or the casino. Now you don't have to do that. You can just pick up your phone, start gambling, lose track of time, lose track of money, and really run into trouble.
We're chatting this morning with Diana Good, who's the executive director for the Connecticut Council on Problem Gambling. And I want to just make sure it's very clear to listeners. The Connecticut Council on Problem Gambling, they are simply a resource. They are people who recognize that gambling addiction is a real thing. It was a problem before online betting, and it's a problem now. And they are simply a resource, and they just want to make sure that they're doing all they can to protect you from going into debt and from gaining an addiction, essentially. So they don't have a political view or a stance on it. It's just a matter of they want to be there for people. Diana, you know, you just brought up a lot of great points as to why we could see, you know, a 200% increase, like you said, in these phone calls for people who need help. Governor Lamont, I know one of the things he looks to are other states who have already given the green light to sports betting, and he says they've been handling it. Do you have data from other states showing that they, too, are seeing upticks in gambling addictions? Do we have any data on surrounding states who have also passed this legislation?
One of the states that we look to is New Jersey, who's one of the first states that passed online gambling and sports betting.
Mm-hmm.
And they were incredibly slammed when people started calling their helpline completely out of control. So Connecticut's not unusual. We definitely knew that was going to happen. We didn't realize how fast it was going to happen. Normally, with a problem gambler, it takes a little while for them to hit rock bottom and for them to realize they need to call the helpline. Now people are getting into trouble so fast that we really had to do a little catch up to hire additional staff to make sure we could handle those calls. And we were able to do that. But so many people are getting into trouble so fast that was one of the things that really caught us off guard. But it's not unusual that this is happening all around the country with the legalization of sports betting and online gambling.
According to the Connecticut Council on Problem Gambling, there's been a 200% uptick in calls for people who are struggling with a gambling addiction and are struggling with the open access to gambling. I want to just back up really quickly. We're talking to Diana Good, the executive director for the council. I want to back up really quickly, Diana, because you had mentioned in giving those facts, you had talked a little bit about how there is a cutoff. We're told there's a cutoff, but it's a little there's a little bit of deception there. What do you mean by that? So if I sign up, okay, I sign up to do some online gambling. Let's say my limit is $500, okay? I don't know how I could afford that, but let's say $500 is my limit to gamble with. What does the program do? The program just says, hey, Melissa, you've reached 500, like, just to let you know. It doesn't say, hey, you're done for the day. It doesn't cut me off. Like, what does that look like?
It does not cut you off. It tells you that you've reached the $500, and you can then change that limit. So there are other things that you can do. You can give yourself a timeout off that app and say, I don't want to gamble for 3 months or 1 month. You can exclude yourself and say, I don't ever want to online gamble anymore. You put your name on a self-exclusion list for 1 year, 5 years, lifetime, and then you can't get on those apps anymore. But if you hit your limit, it doesn't shut you down and say you are done. It just gives you a pop-up that says you're at your limit.
You have to shut yourself down, essentially. You have to have the self-control to say, I'm done.
Correct. And in the heat of the moment, you may not do that. You may just change that limit.
Right.
So there are a lot of misconceptions about what's actually happening.
Well, especially
because that we're working.
Yeah. Oh, no, go for it. That's what I was going to ask is, like, how do you combat it? No, you're right. You're right on the money. Yeah. How do you combat it?
Well, there are a couple things. What we're working on right now is a frequently asked questions section for our website, because we're confused also. And if we're confused, I can imagine how confused consumers are. So we're trying to get consumer protection, FanDuel, DraftKings, Rush Street, the casinos, the lottery, to answer these frequently asked questions so that we know exactly what will happen and people will know exactly what will happen. We also have a new website called responsibleplayct.org that's got tips and tricks about how to gamble responsibly. Things like set that limit, because just in case that limit may pop up and you may say, that's it, I'm done. Set limits on time, set limits on money. There are lots of things that you can do to try to gamble within your means, and all those tips and tricks are on that website, responsibleplayct.org.
And I'm curious, Diana, as we talk about ways to combat it, you know, earlier in the conversation, you were saying, unfortunately, you have a lot of young people who are either in college or post-college, maybe in their first job, and they just don't really understand or grasp the concept of gambling. I have to be honest with you. I've never gambled a day in my life. I have too much anxiety to even order at a restaurant. So I would be horrible in a casino. I would just be awful at it. But I don't even really understand the concept of how some people just get really lucky. Some people know how to have a poker face. Like, I don't get any of it. So I would be that person who'd fall into that category of really not understanding, if I did ever get into it, how severe it can be for your finances and for becoming addicted to it. So my question for you is, for the younger people who maybe have literally no experience, but they decide, I'm going to try sports betting, do you think it's worth, I don't think it's worth passing any laws or anything, but do you think it's worth maybe having college campuses in Connecticut more engaged with talking about gambling addictions and, you know, even places of work? You know, we have sexual harassment training and things like that at the workplace. Is it worth bringing those, you know, the tips and the skills that you're talking about on your website? Is it worth kind of getting those out in companies and on college campuses?
It's really worth it. One of the things that we've been a part of for the last couple of years is the Healthy Campus Initiative, which a number of colleges are part of around the state. And one of the things I said like 4 years ago is we just want to be a question on the survey. When you're asking young people about all these different things that they should be concerned about, drugs, alcohol, sex, guns, violence, all of that, we want it to be a question on the survey. And mm-hmm. we really are now. And our director of programs and services is very involved in Healthy Campus initiatives so that people can understand what are the signs of problem gambling. If you see your roommate walking around campus, you can tell if they're on drugs or alcohol. You can't tell if they're obsessed about gambling. And then you don't see them for a week because they're in their dorm room online gambling and sports betting. So we've been very active trying to get more people to understand the issues of online gambling and sports betting. We'd love to be more involved in the workplace because a lot of times you're not sure what your employees are doing all day. They may be online gambling and sports betting. That may lead to some embezzlements and things like that. So we'd love to talk to companies more about what's going on. High school kids, middle school kids too, a lot of them are starting to get into gambling. It's been a very smooth transition going from gaming to online gambling. So we're very concerned about starting these habits early.
Well, and I think we already have, you know, health classes set up where, like you just said, Diana, we focus so much on substance abuse, and we should. I mean, we should, even at the middle school level. It's important that kids know, you know, we look at fentanyl, we look at marijuana, we look at vaping, we're looking, you know, and I feel like we're adjusting to, you know, when I went to school in middle school, it was all about cigarettes. That's all we talked about was cigarettes. But then it's adjusted to now you're talking about marijuana, you're talking about fentanyl, you're talking about vaping. Those are the big concerns for younger children. And I think we adjust in all other areas, you know, like I can remember with alcohol, Four Loko, and Four Loko became a big deal. Oh my gosh, our college campus blew up over Four Loko and how severe it could be for your health. I'm just not seeing, for, like you said, those younger students, adding gambling addiction to the curriculum. I'm not seeing, and I don't know why it's not being added to like our health course curriculums, because it's a very serious thing. And like you said, it's very easy to access.
And you also don't know who the problem gambler is.
Correct.
A lot of times you can know who the alcoholic is and the drug addict is. You don't know who the problem gambler
is.
And that's one of the biggest issues. But we're trying very hard to get into the college campuses. And I love what we've done with cigarettes. Cigarettes are completely uncool right now. And I think that's phenomenal. Mm-hmm. And so I would love to see that happen with gambling. I hope it's not going to take as long as it took with cigarettes. But I'd love to see us make a little bit more progress with gambling for sure.
Mm-hmm. Diana Good, Executive Director for the Connecticut Council on Problem Gambling. Will you give us the hotline if anybody does need your help, how they can seek you guys out?
888-789-7777. Our website is also ccpg.org, and we've got live chat, both the live chat and the phone number 24/7. You can call us anytime.
Diana, we appreciate you coming on the show. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Diana Good, Executive Director for the Connecticut Council on Problem Gambling here on WICC. I mean, I'm more of an Instagrammer, but this lady right here, she loves her Twitter. Oh, boy. I couldn't think of a better person to talk to than our own Krista Carnes, our social media consultant. After the Twitter's board accepted billionaire Elon Musk's offer to buy the social media company and take it private. Now, I will say, the completion of this deal still requires shareholder and regulatory approval, but it's a pretty good chance this is a done deal. So I had to have Krista Carnes on a little earlier than she typically comes on, which is next week. But Krista, thank you for popping on this morning at last minute. Good morning. How are you?
I'm well. Good morning. Yes. Big bird news.
I mean, how do you feel about it? Like I said, you're a tweeter. You like to tweet. How do you feel about Elon Musk taking over?
I've been on Twitter for a long time until they booted me off and I had to start all over, which I hadn't had time this morning to check to see if my old account is actually like available anymore. It's interesting to me. I mean, do I want one person in charge of, you know, major public platforms? I don't know. It makes me miss the news, you know, the old traditional news sources. But, you know, I mean, this is modern communications, and I think it's interesting. I think it's interesting that Jack Dorsey, the founder and ex-CEO, like, he's tweeted since yesterday a couple of times about his support for Musk and his plan and believes that it will be, you know, scrubbed of, you know, it'll be an even more robust platform for discourse. I think they're going to move to a subscription model because if they take it private and they want to, I don't know if they'll have advertising or how that's going to work, but it sounds like Musk is floating the idea of a subscription service.
So what does that mean? What would that mean, a subscription service?
You know, the same way that I pay for Netflix at X amount of dollars a month and then that would, you know, help fund them. You know, Dorsey's making this comment of, you know, he's always a little, you know, philosophical about things, and he says, oh, this will, you know, keep things, you know, more democratic, and you know, a lot of people are saying this is a win for free speech. I don't know that there was ever too much of a problem with free speech. I do think we need moderation. And I think my biggest concern is that this model will just open the platform up to become just a cesspool of hate in many regards.
That was, yes.
Because if you,
yes. Mm-hmm. Sorry, go on. That was my biggest concern.
No. I mean, that's my issue, right? Like, free speech is what, you know, again, we've talked about this. Free speech is not, A, does not mean free of consequence. B, this is a private company. This is not the government doing anything to quash somebody's opinion. It's an independent company. It's a corporation. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this censorship and all this, I don't think it applies. Do I think that some people are overly punitive with reporting certain accounts? Probably. Do I think it's good to have the ability to report hate or threats? Or, I mean, there's definitely that side to consider. And, you know, how are they going to thread that needle and create a space and have accountability, right? I mean, it is a platform, it is public, but there's a lot of really scary stuff that can happen on any social media platform. And what, you know, I haven't heard Musk talk about that. I've seen him say some very awful things about certain groups of people, and he's entitled to whatever opinion he wants. And Twitter, you know, as long as he up till now hasn't crossed any of their, you know, law or policy guidelines,
sure,
he's free to say what he wants. Everybody's free to say what they want, but there is consequences for your actions.
Well, especially if you're going to take over, you know, a major entity like Twitter. And I'm curious, Krista, in your professional opinion, do you think Jack Dorsey is very open to the idea of Elon Musk taking over? Because well, A, it's not like he's not making a great profit off of this, but B, it sort of takes him out of the limelight of being the scapegoat. I mean, when you look at stories like, you know, the former president, Donald Trump, being kicked off of Twitter, even recently Kanye West being taken off of Twitter temporarily, do you think Jack Dorsey's like, you know what, I made a product, it does its job, I was proud of it, maybe I didn't cross my T's and dot my I's, but I felt good about it, but honestly, in recent years, I have been under attack constantly, I feel like I live in Washington, D.C. practically because I'm constantly questioned about Twitter. Let me put this on somebody else who clearly does not care if he is constantly under a microscope. Do you think Jack Dorsey's thinking that?
I can only look at what he's said about this. I mean, he's taking sort of a philosophical approach. I think he said yesterday, like, you know, this is one of the downsides of starting a company is that you have to, you know, especially with shareholders, is that you have to meet certain, it's not the, you know, he's that old tech, early tech boom thing. I mean, he hit it on an idea. Twitter to him is an idea. And I get that. But this is reality.
Right. This is now a lifeline for people.
Things grow. Mm-hmm. It's a public forum in many respects. And I think he thinks Musk is going to come back and, you know, create different algorithms so that more people are going to be able to say things. I don't know what it looks like, but you know what? Like, Elon Musk is not a data scientist. He's not a coder. He's, you know,
right.
He's running SpaceX. He's running Tesla. I, you know, when you come in and you try to change an entire culture of an organization, you got to be there and you got to have a clear, you know, picture. But you're also, I mean, you know, I don't know. I mean, this is where, you know, the whole be careful what you wish for kind of mentality comes in, because we don't know what's going to happen next. And we don't know, you know, what I mean, it's going to take issues that are going to force him to refine or define what's going on. Right. So if he changes things and there's lawsuits because something happens, like, if this happens with anything, you know, he's going to have to grapple with some of this. Mm-hmm. And Dorsey, you know, he's still involved. He's still on the board.
Right.
He gave his unanimous consent. So he obviously thinks, you know, what my bigger challenge is the idea that we live in a country where, or in an environment where one person, Mark Zuckerberg, Jeff Bezos, you know, these billionaires have so much access to so much data.
Yes.
And what is that going to do for them? I mean, they want to make money. Let's be honest, right? He didn't buy it. I do not believe that Elon Musk believes that he doesn't need to make money on this, right? He didn't just spend $44 billion.
Right.
But he said that. This is not about me making money.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's not true.
Right.
Like, I just can't buy that.
Right.
You know what I mean?
You can't be willing to drop that kind of money if you're not willing to make a profit off of it.
Right, at some point. And there are people, the shareholders are probably, you know, yep, they're swimming in it this morning. And that's, you know, that's the nature of business. So, okay. But, you know, here again, and this is where I think, you know, a lot of people are against, like, government oversight. And I understand it has to be taken, you know, it has to be responsibly addressed. But, like,
sure.
This is where these platforms are so far ahead in terms of their existence. They're, like, in their, you know, they're huge. They're still in a growth spurt
mm-hmm.
for the last 10 years or
right.
so. But we haven't caught up with what's the damage? What's the potential damage? How much do we deserve to have somebody paying attention to what they're doing? But they're private companies. So, you know, it's the media. It's not like, I was listening to a podcast the other day. Jimmy Kimmel was the host, whatever you think of him. And he was talking about, you know, he's still on a network, right? He's still on a traditional
right.
network. And traditional networks still require equal time if you're talking about political issues for candidates
mm-hmm.
and how that makes his life, you know, really hard sometimes because different affiliates in different cities have different states, have different rules, you know. No cable news network is under the same scrutiny. No social media platform. No podcast. You know, like, it's so... It
ha- oh, absolutely. Our, There's an unfair our, advantage and
yeah,
disadvantage.
Our media...
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, like, that was established back in the day for good reason. And I think it is
for good reason, but unfortunately that's not the norm, and that's not the majority. Elon Musk taking over Twitter, and we're chatting this morning with Krista Carnes, our social media consultant. So Krista, after listening to, for example, Jimmy Kimmel, who said, you know, I still have to have unbiased news. I've got to have both sides of the story. You're competing with social media where kind of anything goes, and even major networks where anything goes. My biggest fear with this, which we kind of hinted at, is the idea of more online bullying, honestly. And I'm not even talking about kids. I mean, that's always been a concern. But I look at the idea of just blatantly attacking and hurting people with words behind a screen. Like, I know one of the things Elon Musk said was, I want to stop the bots from getting on and all of that. And that, great, I would love that. But I'm not talking bots. I'm talking trolls. I'm talking people who know they are mean and they are saying mean things. And they are destroying people through social media, and they're not held accountable because they're not these big entities like a Kanye West, for example, or a Donald Trump. So, and there are many others who have honestly gone under the radar with opposite viewpoints who should have probably been banned as well. But I'm just saying, if you're not this big entity and they're just going on, I think this only makes it easier for them to continue with these actions. And I don't know if that's okay. I don't know what this is going to mean for that.
Right. I mean, and here's the thing, like, he didn't have to tell us how he's going to transform Twitter, right? Like, I'm sure he shared it with some board members or what he thinks philosophically should be different. And, you know, let's, will there still be moderation? Is he still going to allow hate to flourish? I mean, will hate flourish on this site now? I mean, I think that's a very legitimate question. I don't know that we can have an answer in advance. Will he be responsible for anything that comes out of that? I mean, that's always been sort of the what social
question.
Media has been able to say. Well, we have certain policies in place. We can't control, can't control certain things. You know, these are algorithms, and so I don't know what he's going to do. I just think if you open up everything, then you're going to get every kind of thing, and that's fine. Like, then I just think that it will become less of a place of discourse, I don't think you can hold both things at the same time. I don't think you can say, oh, this is this public forum and isn't it great? And we're going to we're going to open up, we're not going to restrict less voices, right? Because,
but then you're making it accurate. Right.
Be.
Right. And look, Elon Musk is a brilliant guy. I don't want anyone to think that this is a horrific idea. I don't know what this is going to mean. I mean, Elon Musk is clearly successful for many reasons. So it's not like he's a dumb guy by any means. It's just a question of how do you say, I'm going to make this more of an open platform, an open forum. It's going to allow people to bring free speech back and not have that elephant in the room of, is this acceptable or not? But then when you open
that.
Well,
but by virtue of making.
Right.
But I would say that if he makes it a subscription-based service, then it will remain to be seen who decides to subscribe.
Right.
Because
that's true.
If that's, because if I'm not going to enter into a place where, A, I'm going to be attacked for what I'm thinking,
sure.
Where I don't feel that there's gen. And I don't know that it's not that way right now, but at least I know that there is. Because if he makes it a subscription model, then only other people with subscriptions see it.
Correct,
so then you create this echo chamber, right? And you start talking to yourself. And that might be fine. And that may be ultimately what happens, is that a lot of people opt not to subscribe because it's
but
not,
that could
it's
also
not
mean tunnel vision. But that could also mean tunnel vision.
Absolutely.
People who are either stuck in that world of not knowing any other source or feeling like, oh, I've got all this support for people who all agree with me, but you're missing the whole other side, which is, I think, what you're getting at.
Well,
when
you mentioned the Jimmy Kimmel thing, the real FTC requirement was for the both sides is really only when they bring on candidates who are running for something.
Right.
Politicians, right, which, So, that is one level of scrutiny, but they also changed it when cable news changed, and quite frankly, no matter what political spectrum you fall on, there is very little objective news sources out there, right? A lot of it is opinion. MSNBC, Fox News, most of that content is driven by opinion, and they're allowed to do that, right? They don't have to, right? It's not the same standards as maybe in the past, right?
Right.
So it's a media structure, right? And they're selling ads, and they want to sell ads. So in order to sell ads, you have to be provocative, and to be provocative, or you know, you got to get clicks and you got to get viewers and all this. So like it's very much the same thing. If he goes to a subscription model, I don't know. There's no as a consumer of that content, I can't just not watch. You know, like I could boycott advertisers. That's always the big fear in public companies that are advertising driven, right? Or we're gonna boycott X because of this.
Sure.
You know, they keep supporting this nonsense in my mind. Then
right.
I'm gonna not. You know, and that can create pain. For the entity, for the show, for the voice, for the host, whatever.
It's a very trickle-down effect. Unfortunately, Krista, we have run out of time. I'm sure we're going to continue this conversation, though, as this story develops.
Sure.
And I thank you so much for being here with us.
All right. Have a good day.
Thanks, Krista. You too. We'll see what happens. Krista Carnes here on WICC. Did you know more than 100,000 people are waiting for life-saving organ transplants? Every 9 minutes, another person is added to the national transplant waiting list. April is Donate Life Month, and those facts and figures all come from DonateLife.net. And joining me this morning is someone who understands how important it is to give and has given time and time again, the ultimate, I think, sacrifice to help other people he may not even necessarily know. Anthony Cerner is here this morning, director of philanthropy and a very good friend of mine. Anthony, welcome to the show. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Melissa. I'm great. How are you?
I'm great. Anthony, tell people your story. You are a 3-time organ donor?
Yeah. Wow. So I had this amazing experience in 2015. A friend of mine posted on Facebook that she was going to donate her kidney to her best friend's son. And she said, I'm going to do this thing that's going to be a little inconvenient for me for a few days, but I'm going to save somebody's life. And me, being somebody who's still in school and a little bit of a contrarian, I said, there's absolutely no way you can donate a kidney and not be in a constant state of medical crisis. So I immediately jump online. And sure enough, you find out pretty quickly, some people are only born with one kidney and they never know for their whole life. Tens of thousands of us have donated a kidney and gone on to live completely normal and healthy lives. And that ended up being my experience. My friend Wendy inspired me to help somebody else, and I donated a kidney to Lance, who was a stranger to me before that surgery, and became a good friend in 2016. Through the bone marrow registry, I got lucky and connected with a leukemia patient who needed stem cells after her treatments in 2017. And then in 2020, I donated a section of liver to a new friend, Martin, out in West Pennsylvania, who had liver cancer and needed a new liver after his treatments.
This is wild to me. So, okay. First of all, back up. So you did some research. You said, okay, I can live without these things. And the idea of just helping random strangers, that just pulled at your heartstrings.
You know, I was live in Bridgeport near a Methodist church, and they've got this little setup near the entrance of the church where it's take a scarf and leave a scarf. And you know, this winter, it really struck me, this idea, like if I was walking around with two hats and it was cold in the winter, and I didn't need that second hat, you would share it with somebody who needed the hat, right? And that was my perspective. Once I had learned that it was healthy and safe and I could go on and live a normal life, I got to tell you, Melissa, 5 days after my kidney donation, I wasn't even taking Tylenol. I'm a semi-professional skydiver. My job on the weekends is to video skydivers.
Wow.
I jumped out of airplanes 27 days after my surgery.
Really?
And I'm completely healthy today. So, yeah, you can do this amazing thing, get to be a part of something really special. And if you're healthy before the surgery, you'll come out healthy on the other side. It's pretty cool.
That's unbelievable. And we're talking this morning to Anthony Cernera, who is the director of philanthropy at St. Vincent's Medical Center. But today we're really talking about his personal life. He's a three-time organ donor. And so would you say the kidney transplant, would you say that surgery was your most severe of the three?
The liver's a bigger surgery. So the kidney is laparoscopic. We do this actually at Hartford HealthCare. We usually keep people in the hospital for less than 36 hours. It's minimally invasive. I have friends who have both donated a kidney and had a C-section and thought their C-section was much more invasive than their kidney donation. The liver donation, a little more significant. They open you up. It's a major surgery. I was in the hospital for 7-8 days recovering. Took a little bit longer before I was out running again. But the stem cells through the bone marrow registry, that was the easiest. I went back to work later in the afternoon. It's basically almost like drawing blood. It's like a plasma transfer. So that was a pretty easy process.
And you don't worry at all, Anthony, that at some point if you get older, you know, let's say you have kidney failure or something like that, you don't worry that you may need that second kidney.
There are so many remarkable protections in place for living donors. First off, you get amazing care, and no health system will put you in a position of making a donation if you're not healthy enough to do so and be healthy afterwards. Second, insurance companies don't charge you more for insurance. You know, there's no negative health outcomes. But the federal government, and especially here in the state of Connecticut, we've passed a bunch of cool legislation that ensures if you were a living donor and for some reason later on in life you did, you know, by natural causes 30 years later develop kidney disease and needed your own kidney, you'd be at the very top of the list. The other interesting thing, I get a lot of questions for people who are considering it. Gosh, what if my brother or my sister, my father, my son, daughter needed a kidney? What about them? There is a voucher system now. So if you donate to a stranger or somebody not in your immediate family, and you then have this ticket which you can give to a loved one, who would put them at the top of the list. So it would be as if you had a chance to also donate to your loved one. So yeah, there's a lot of protections in place. There's financial assistance for people if you have to take time off from work to get through it. There's a lot of protections for donors.
Wow. So you would do it all again, it sounds like.
You know, it's such a special thing to be a part of. I have three amazing friends now who I wouldn't have met otherwise, and absolutely would. And I try to, you know, I don't love talking about myself, Melissa. I love when you and I get together and talk about helping cancer patients in Bridgeport. But I think it's important to share my story because that's how I can continue to try to help this way. And if my friend Wendy hadn't shared hers, I wouldn't have known that this was even humanly possible.
And I think it is an amazing story, Anthony. And I am glad that you're sharing it, especially during this time where we're bringing attention to donating life and how you can save so many by being selfless. And I think that's incredible. If people want to learn more about the process, Anthony, what would you recommend to them? Where should they go?
Well, I got to tell you, it is not just because I work for Hartford HealthCare that I say this. It is also because being able to have my post-transplant care so close to home, I really encourage people who want to learn more about transplant, whether they are ill and they need assistance, or if they'd like to find out if this is something they could do for a family member, a friend, or even extraordinarily a stranger, HartfordHealthCare.org/transplant is a great place to get started. And we've got services down here in Fairfield and Bridgeport. I literally could walk to the transplant center here that followed my care and made making sure that I was on track. They check you every 6 months. They do your blood work up. You get a thorough exam for 2 years after your donation. So having the convenience of that center close to home has been pretty cool.
Wow, that's amazing. Anthony Cernera, we so appreciate you coming on and sharing your story with us. And thank you for saving three lives. That's beautiful.
Melissa, I just need 5 seconds if you'll indulge me. I want to thank you for what you do. For those of us who listen to you in the morning, you just bring joy and happiness. And when there's a lot of the opposite in the world, it's a great way to start our day. And you use your platform to do things like this, to share good stories and, you know, the work we do around Swim Across the Sound. You've been such a great champion helping cancer patients in our community. I just wanted to make sure I got a chance to thank you for being you.
Anthony, you're going to make me cry. Thank you so much. That's so nice of you. I appreciate you saying that. Did you give, Melissa, you didn't give your heart away. That's good. You kept your heart. I could tell you kept your heart. So there you go. It's working very well.
Very kind of you. That's wonderful. It's so nice hearing your voice. Thank you, friend.
You too, friend. It's so good to hear from you. Anthony Cernera here on WICC.